appearing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General William Wolford. Mr. Wolford.
Thank you. My name is William C. Wolford, appearing for the petitioner of the state in this case. The defendant in this case was originally charged with two counts of physical abuse of a child. The complaint alleged that the neurosurgeon who performed surgery on the victim observed two skull fractures which appeared to have been caused by two different objects. The preliminary hearing was held, and the defendant was bound over on the charges. At the preliminary, the neurosurgeon expressed the opinion that there were two separate blows that caused the two separate skull fractures. Incidentally, the defendant claimed at page 13 of her brief that the facts support the view that she struck the victim twice in rapid succession with a beer bottle, the one found broken in the victim's room with the last fragments in his crib. This is not what the record shows. According to the testimony at the preliminary hearing, a broken beer bottle was found in another room. That's page 18 of document 10, and pieces of an end table type of glass for a hanging macrame were found in the victim's crib, and that's record 10, page 19. In any event, the defendant subsequently entered into a plea agreement dealing with a number of charges that were pending against her. She pled guilty to some charges, others were dismissed, and others were not charged at all. Under the plea agreement, she pled to two counts of first-degree reckless injury under an amended information. During the plea colloquy, the trial court emphasized to the defendant she was pleading guilty to two separate counts and the evidentiary basis for those two counts, that there were at least two serious blows to the victim's head with two different instruments, according to the doctor's testimony at the preliminary hearing. The defendant acknowledged this and pled guilty to the two counts. Counsel stipulated to the complaint and the preliminary hearing as a sufficient factual basis to support the charges. It's the state's position that in pleading guilty to those two charges, after a thorough colloquy about the fact that there were two different counts involving damage to the victim's skull from two different blows, the defendant waived the right to later challenge the count to the multiplicitous. The state asked this court to follow the reasoning of the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in United States versus Brochi Construction Company, Inc. This court has traditionally followed the decisions of that court in interpreting the double jeopardy provisions of the federal and the state constitutions. The crucial language in Brochi is quoted at page 9 and 10 of my brief. The court stated that by entering a plea of guilty, the accused is not simply stating that he did the discrete acts described in the indictment. He is admitting guilt of a substantive crime. The court explained, therefore, just as a defendant who pleads guilty to a single count admits guilt to the specified offense, so too does a defendant who pleads guilty to two counts with facial allegations of distinct offenses concede that he has committed two separate crimes. That is what we contend happened in this case. The defendant admitted by a plea that she committed two separate crimes. By doing so, she waived or forfeited her double jeopardy claim, assuming that her plea was a valid one. Now, the Court of Appeals in this case relied on its decision in State versus Hubbard. They distinguished Brochi because Hubbard was a direct appeal rather than a collateral attack, as Brochi was, and because the double jeopardy claim was ascertainable on record in Hubbard and it was not in Brochi. It is true that Brochi involved a collateral attack. However, the state believes that Judge Lunson was correct in concluding in his dissent that the rationale of Brochi should apply to direct appeals as well as collateral attacks. I want to emphasize the state is not contending that the defendant had no remedy in this case. She could challenge the validity of her pleas. In fact, she did this in her post-conviction motion. She contended her pleas were involuntary. She contended that she received ineffective assistance of counsel. The trial court ruled against her. But if her pleas are valid, we contend her pleas constitute a waiver or forfeiture of the double jeopardy claims in this case.
Your counsel.
Counsel, this case first went to the appellate court, and first of all, there was no merit.
That's correct.
The appellate court then said no, that they thought that this should go back to the trial court because they wanted them to look at the question of double jeopardy, correct?
Right.
Judge Mason then, in which I found, since I've been up here, to, well, it was a lengthy written opinion, I think almost 50 pages.
That's correct.
That he went over it very carefully and felt that because of the testimony of the neurosurgeon as to these two blows, one had glass and the other was by a blunt instrument, that there were two distinct acts and that the defendant clearly understood, he took pains, I think, to go over this, that she was pleading to this, quote, amended charge. And, in fact, I think the potential was 61 and a half years, and she received, what, 10 and 5 in, yes, 10 and 5 in one, and I think it was 10 and 5 and 15 and 5 in the other. I can't recall, but in any way.
I think the total was 15 in one and the total was 10 in the other.
It was about half of what the potential was. And then you sent the letter correcting the 128 years that I think District Attorney Fairchild, or someone used, Mr. Fairchild, someone used a different analysis as far as what was the plea and what were the number of years. My question is, after summarizing that, the main issue here is whether or not there was, and we should adopt Broci, or whether or not we should continue to use Hubbard. And you're saying there's no difference between a direct and a collateral attack. And just tell me why you think there's no difference.
Well, there's certainly a difference between a direct and a collateral attack in many respects. But in terms of the Broci analysis, I don't think that there's any reason to distinguish between the two.
Certainly, there have been, courts have been less solicitous. Collateral is something that I find that generally is not something that's being frowned on.
They have generally, but I would say not with respect to this issue. I have, and I think Judge Lunston indicated this in his dissent, I haven't found any cases that said that Broci didn't apply to a direct appeal just because it was a direct appeal. There aren't many cases out there, but few are, you know, I haven't found any that are distinguishing it on that basis. I think the defendant can still challenge the validity of the plea, but if the plea is a valid one, I think there should be a waiver or forfeiture on a direct appeal as well as a collateral attack. And I think one of the primary reasons for saying that is just respect for the plea process. It doesn't seem appropriate. It seems to tarnish the integrity of the plea process when someone pleads to two distinct offenses, admits that they've committed two distinct offenses, and then goes ahead and challenges the plea. Now, in this case, I understand there's a difference because the Court of Appeals told them to go back. But
counsel, your position is the defendant can challenge the validity of the plea. The issue in this case is, can the defendant challenge the validity of the plea on double jeopardy grounds? Can the defendant say, this plea of guilty is not valid because I pled to two counts when under the law there is only one count? Therefore, it can't be a knowing, voluntary plea. You keep saying she pled to two counts. Well, sure, that's a fact. The problem is, she says, under law, it's one count. And the government has no right, constitutional rights, violates her constitutional rights, in forcing her to continue to plea to two counts. And this is all on direct appeal. And you say she pled guilty to count one and count two. Agreed. And you're saying from that there's therefore a waiver of double jeopardy. And the issue is, unless the issue is, does a judge have to say to her, you know, it may be a multiplicity issue. I'm not ruling on it. Have you discussed multiplicity with your counsel? Do you understand multiplicity means blah, 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 if anyone can define it? And that you might have a valid constitutional defense to one of these charges. Do you waive your double jeopardy rights? She didn't do that in this plea colloquy, as I understand it.
I agree that there was
okay.
No
All right.
discussion expressly at the plea colloquy of double jeopardy.
And is it the state's position that if there's a plea to several counts and there's appears to be on the plea colloquy no problem, that is a waiver of double jeopardy, end of story?
If the double jeopardy violation is not apparent on the face of the record, if they would have to go outside the record to prove the double jeopardy violation, yes, that's our position. And we think that the vehicle to deal with that and the concern you're raising is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, saying she didn't get adequate information from her counsel about that potential double jeopardy claim.
And it was prejudicial.
Which is actually defiled in this case.
And it was prejudicial.
Right.
Okay. So your position is, in this case, where on the face of the documents, there appears to be two separate counts on the basis of fact and law.
Yes.
Then there is a waiver of double jeopardy by a plea.
Yes.
But if on the face of the document there appears to be a problem as to whether it's a matter of fact or law, that it's two counts, then the plea does not waive double jeopardy.
That's correct.
And where do you get that rule of law from?
Well, I get it from Brochi, which interpreted Mena. And I acknowledge that there are certainly other cases in Wisconsin that go against us.
Like?
Well, to start, the first one I would start with is Morris. But Morris was decided before Brochi. And then Hubbard. And then Robinson.
Hubbard was a court of appeals case?
That's right. Robinson was your case where they basically followed Hubbard. But Robinson was the latest case that I'm talking about. And in that case, the state conceded that there was no waiver. But it was a case that it was apparent on the record that there was a double jeopardy violation because they amended the information through a plea bargain, and the person ended up pleading to two of the same counts for the same conduct. So it was clear that it was a violation. There was no question it was multiplicity.
Mr. Wolford, I understand that you believe you can distinguish Hubbard, but I want to follow up the Chief's question about Robinson, because although it was a state's concession, in Robinson the court said that an express waiver of double jeopardy claim in a plea agreement is needed for a waiver of a double jeopardy claim. It doesn't link it to the Brochi, while it cites Hubbard, it doesn't link it to the Brochi analysis, it doesn't separate it out. It just says if you're going to waive double jeopardy, you have to do it. So are you asking us, as part of this decision, to withdraw this language from Robinson?
Well, I think, as I recall, Robinson relied on Hubbard
You can distinguish
in part.
You say you can distinguish Hubbard, and I accept that argument. This is a little bit different because this doesn't go through the Hubbard analysis. This is just a statement by the court that you have to have an express waiver. So, once again, my question is, are you asking us as part of your argument here to withdraw this language?
I think the language in Robinson is too broad in several respects. I don't think it adequately takes into consideration the Brochi type situation I'm talking about, which was not, in fact, present in that case. And I also think that it is probably too broad in that it says an express waiver of a double jeopardy claim in a plea agreement is needed for a waiver of a double jeopardy claim. I don't see why in a case where there isn't a plea agreement, there's just a plea, and there's a plea colloquy that where the defendant expressly waives a double jeopardy argument, I don't see why that wouldn't waive a double jeopardy claim as well.
That wasn't really argued in Robinson, was it? There wasn't in Robinson, as I recall, that issue wasn't argued or briefed before the court.
No, that's right. And this comes from Hubbard, where the state was making two arguments. Mm-hmm. The state was arguing the plea waived the double jeopardy claim, and in addition, the plea agreement waived the double jeopardy claim. And the court rejected both, and in rejecting the second, they stated there would have to be an express waiver. Just the fact that it's a plea agreement doesn't mean that there's no double jeopardy claim, because the state gave something up. That doesn't mean that that there's a waiver, so it would have to be expressed. And that's been carried forward then in cases subsequent to that.
So you believe that we could, we could certainly live with Robinson. Do you think we'd have to withdraw the language? I don't believe we would, because it's an entirely different situation.
It is a different situation, and certainly it is correct that an express waiver in a plea agreement would be a waiver, but it's not the only way that there could be a waiver.
Are you asking us to withdraw language from other cases that stand for the proposition that double jeopardy is an exception to the waiver rule? I mean, that, you know, Hubbard and Robinson aren't the only cases. There's a number of cases that have, if you put that in Westlaw, you'll come up with a number of them. That's kind of throughout. To say throughout would be an exaggeration, but to say there's a number of cases that are, I don't know how many, I just pulled up five or six this morning, you know.
To the extent that the cases say that double jeopardy is always an exception, mm-hmm. I think that the issue, once again, is it apparent on its face? And there are a lot of cases that deal with this MENA exception in other areas besides double jeopardy.
Do you know,
it turns out whether it's apparent on its face or not.
I did real quickly. Are you able to tell me, since you're advocating that we are withdrawing language from cases, how many cases we're going to have to withdraw that language from? Did you do any check? I mean, there's quite a large number. Large is so relative, but it isn't just two or three or four or five where we've repeated that maxim.
I don't know for certain. My recollection is that there's similar language in Moe Taylor.
That's right. That's one of them. Mm-hmm. And that was a 2002 of this court.
Right. Yeah. And most of these cases are right in terms of whether, in fact, there was a waiver, because most of those involved not issues regarding whether the charges were identical in fact, but they involve questions of what's the appropriate unit of prosecution, such as in Hubbard or something else, so that it was apparent on the record. But I think the language is too broad.
Counselor, if I understand what you're saying, you're not asking us to say that double jeopardy is always waived. And can you think of a case that you can tell us that we'd have to specifically withdraw language from that uses the always waived rather than under the facts of that particular case?
Well, if you go back to Morris.
That's in a footnote.
Yes, it is.
And it was dicta, actually, in Morris.
You could argue a lot of these are, you know, are dicta.
Well, but you know our rule. If we go ahead and
state something and reach out and do it. We don't have dicta. You're familiar with that?
Are you talking about Supreme Court cases?
Yes.
Well, I think that I don't have it in front of me, but I think Multaylor may be too broad.
Now, Hubbard said, and I was looking at Robinson to see where the sentence, an express waiver of a double jeopardy claim in a plea agreement is needed for a waiver of a double jeopardy claim. I was glad to see there was a citation. And Hubbard is the citation. It says, however, we conclude, well, I'll start the sentence before, the state would have us conclude that the plea agreement accomplished a waiver because the basis for the double jeopardy complaint was known to Hubbard when he accepted the agreement. So there the state was arguing he knew he had a double jeopardy problem or defense, and he went ahead and pled anyway. But then the court went ahead and said, however, we conclude that awareness of a double jeopardy defense at the time of the plea agreement, which would, you have you found that? It's at page 62.
Yes, I got it.
Which would include the concept that it was on the face of it. But here it says, the awareness of a double jeopardy defense at the time of the plea agreement is not a substitute for express waiver and does not distinguish a plea from a plea agreement for the purpose of waiving the defense. So do you read that as saying that under no conditions is a plea, whether it's an agreement or not, without an express waiver of double jeopardy, adequate?
I'm not sure that I think that particular sentence that you just read to me is incorrect, but then you go down to the next paragraph. Absent an express waiver, I guess you could put that in the context of the previous one. But I think you have to read Hubbard within its context.
The facts are narrower. But the language of the case talks about not a plea agreement and that there's no distinction. So, I mean, it's broader and you can say, well, it's a throwaway. And I don't dispute that, but it is there. And that what happens is it then gets picked up because
it's a statement
and can read this. I mean, it's not that Hubbard was read improperly. Your complaint is Hubbard went further than the facts of that case. Although Hubbard, the state claimed he knew. And the court says it doesn't matter whether you know or not. You haven't waived it expressly.
As part of the plea agreement.
Yeah. Right. You haven't waived it expressly as part of the plea. Then the plea itself or the plea agreement itself doesn't do it. And you want that changed.
The
concept
express waiver as part of the plea agreement is the only way that a double jeopardy claim
You want us to say, no, that's not right, that if it's on the face of the plea of the documents, then it's not waived. But if it's not on the face, it is waived.
Right. Although, once again, I think that there could be an express waiver.
Sure. Even if it's on the face. I mean, I'll take two.
Yeah, it doesn't relate to a plea agreement at all, or isn't
for minor felonies rather than the big one.
Yeah.
Okay. Even if the two minor ones are the same.
Now, just to briefly address the second issue.
Justice Bradley has
questions. Before we get to the second issue, so with regard to the language in Hubbard and the language in Hubbard also that distinguishes the Brogy case, you want us to get rid of that language. I mean, Hubbard says, well, Brogy can be distinguished because it was a collateral attack, and so you want us to get rid of that language, right?
Yes.
And you want us to get rid of the language regarding or express waiver that the Chief was just talking about in Hubbard. Okay. Now, what language in Robinson do you want us to get rid of?
I guess this sentence can be read in two different ways. Page 562, or paragraph 13 of the opinion, an express waiver of a double jeopardy claim in a plea agreement is needed for a waiver of a double jeopardy claim. To the extent that can be read as meaning in a plea agreement doesn't waive unless it's expressed, that's probably correct. To the extent it means if you're going to waive double jeopardy as a result of the plea process, you've got to have an express waiver in the plea agreement, then I think it's...
It probably means the latter because it cites to Hubbard at the relevant page. I mean, that's... I think if you look at it, you said it was at 652 in Robinson. Where is it? 561, 562. The sentence you read then cites to Hubbard at 657, so it means...
Right.
Yeah, so it means latter. So you got to get rid of that language in Robinson. You've got to get rid of some additional language in Hubbard. And as to other cases that we have, is it Mulhaler in 2002? We may or may not have to get rid of some of those others. And Court of Appeals, there's several Court of Appeals cases since Grouchy that have that. We have to get rid of it in that, those two.
And going back to Morris. Morris,
yeah, Morris
has
just
been changed because of Grouchy. I mean...
Although Hubbard cited Morris with approval after Grouchy, so...
Yeah, it
did. So this, we got to go through our computers pretty carefully, I suppose.
Counsel, just so I understand, because I asked a similar question, particularly in Robinson, you thought it was a different situation. You're saying no, it is not. We should get rid of the language there?
Well, I think it can be read to suggest that, I think it can be read in two ways. I think it could be read to suggest that the only way that you waive double jeopardy as part of a plea is if you have an express waiver in a plea agreement.
Well, we could leave the language in Robinson if we were to do anything and just qualify what you're talking about here.
Reinterpret it and reinterpret Hubbard.
I don't think that's correct. Right?
Just get rid of the footnote that cites the Hubbard premise. We could do that because it's clear what it means when you look at the footnote to Hubbard.
Then as to, well, my red light is...
I know. So. Thank you, counsel. Michael J. Fairchild, representing Ms. Kelty.
I'm representing Rachel Kelty, and I would like to state for at the onset, when we take a look at the facts, the more I've looked at this case, the more potential for challenges on factual basis of multiplicity arise. I named just one in my brief. It is true that the beer bottle head was in the room where Rachel Kelty had been lying down, which was adjoining the room where the child was. There was also the possibility of Ms. Kelty striking the child repeatedly with both hands, separate object in both hands, in the same course of action.
Mr. Fairchild, are you satisfied that procedurally, the status of this case as it's before our court would preclude us from making a determination as to whether or not the charges were multiplicious?
I believe so, Your Honor, because there has never been a hearing on the factual challenge to the multiplicity issue. It's never been developed at the trial court level. There's a criminal complaint and there's a preliminary hearing, and that's all we have.
And there's been no determination as to that issue by the trial court judge. There's been a determination on waiver, as I understand it.
Arguably, in the decision of Judge Mason, he decided that there was not a viable multiplicity argument.
But you're saying there was no hearing on that issue?
That's correct. Ultimately, if the court upholds the Court of Appeals, this matter would go back for an evidentiary hearing on whether the state could carry its burden on whether they had sufficient evidence to support separate charges. is.
Thank you.
I actually...
Mr. Fairchild, I want to correct. That was Mr. Lambert. This is on page 134 of the state's brief. We were talking about the number of years in prison. That's right.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
As this case unfolded, when was the first time that the defendant indicated there was a multiplicity problem?
If we depend upon the testimony at the post-conviction motion, her trial counsel said that it was an issue right from the start, right from the time of the preliminary hearing, where there were active discussions between herself and the district attorney, and she was actively trying to get the district attorney to drop one of the two counts. And he specifically said, if you file a motion challenging this, there's going to be no deal. If you take the testimony of Rachel Kelty, it was never discussed. It was never discussed, or it was never discussed in a manner that she understood it. And please understand, here is a child that was, and I say a child, who was 17 and who had been in jail away from any support system for 6 months on antidepressants, no high school diploma. And she was trying to make sense out of a very, very complicated issue of double jeopardy and multiplicity. She testified that it was never raised. She never heard the term multiplicity. She never heard the term double jeopardy, and that she certainly didn't intend to waive it. So if you take the testimony of the trial counsel, it arose right at the beginning. And she knew right at the beginning that if she tried to challenge multiplicity on the record, that the deal would be off.
When was the first time that the court was informed that there was a double jeopardy, multiplicity issue?
Using the term court broadly, it was the Court of Appeals upon the submission of the first no merit report by the first appellate counsel. It was the Court of Appeals that pointed to the record and said, there might be a multiplicity argument here. Go back and check to see whether there's a reasonable basis for it and whether Ms. Kelty wishes to pursue it. And then there was a subsequent no-merit report filed saying that that appellate counsel at that time felt that there wasn't a factual basis for a multiplicity argument, but that the client still would want to... I don't think he addressed at that point whether Rachel Kelty wanted to pursue it. The Court of Appeals at that point said, well, we do find that there's a multiplicity issue here. We want you to go back and see if Rachel Kelty wants to pursue it, and if so, please assign additional counsel. And at that point, I was assigned.
My interest is balancing constitutional protections and fairness with some kind of judicial efficiency where defendants don't try to get the best deal they can and then sandbag the state and do the whole thing over again. There are other times if we said you never waive a multiplicity double jeopardy claim by entering a plea bargain without doing it explicitly on the record. I mean, do you get to make that claim after the fact almost any time there's multiple charges?
And
what makes sense here for the system?
Well, and frankly, from the start of the Supreme Court, you accepting this, to me it was clear that this is a public policy type of issue. And I struggle with what are the options here, and I see three options. But I think that Hubbard is correct, particularly in instances where the multiplicity issue hinges upon what facts might be able to be produced. And I think that Hubbard should be kept in place completely because right from the start, the prosecution is in possession of the evidence that they can or might use to prove what choices, and the prosecution, the state, is given tremendous discretion as to how they're going to charge that incident. There is some case law to indicate, and in fact it was argued initially, or stated initially by appellate counsel, that every punch is a separate charge. Perhaps the state could bring a separate charge for every cut that was on the child's head. The doctor said that besides there being one wound in the base of the head that pierced the skin and caused bleeding and depressed the skull, and another wound above the left ear that did not cut the skin but depressed the skull, there were approximately 20 other lacerations. And here we have the doctor saying, given the amount of blood in a child, if this child didn't get immediate attention, this child could have died from bleeding. Well, let's look at that. This charge of reckless injury hinges upon each injury being a great bodily harm. And great bodily harm, the only portion of the definition that fits here is substantial risk of death. And we have a doctor saying 20 wounds on the head, one serious infraction or cut at the base of the head, no cut on the side of the head. If risk of dying from bleeding is the risk of death involved here, could the district attorney have charged out 20 additional counts of injury by or reckless injury, reckless endangerment here, one for every count, or is that one incident with all of them bleeding?
Mr. Fairchild, if I can follow up on that. As I understood Mena versus New York, Mena didn't stand for the proposition that, or didn't deal with the issue of waiver, per se. Mena dealt with the fact that you didn't have a basis for the second charge. And because you don't have a basis for a second charge, you can't haul the person into court on that second charge. Broci was the case that dealt separately with the question of waiver.
Right.
The concern I have about the argument that I'm hearing now is that it's one thing to say that there's no basis for a second charge here, therefore we have a Mena violation. It's another thing to say, well, it could be that there's no basis for a second charge, but it could be that there is a basis for the second charge and we've never had that hearing on it. And I guess my question is, does that then throw this into a Broci type situation as opposed to a Mena situation? You understand the difference?
I understand the difference, and my answer is no, because these two counts were based upon the injury to the base of the head, which caused bleeding, the injury to the side of the head above the ear, which did not cause bleeding, and the only evidence of record of a risk of death is bleeding. And so, is there a basis for the second injury? So there is a Mena issue. But I was leading to trying to answer the question of Justice Prosser about what are the alternatives and should it stay with Hubbard. And the reason you should stay with Hubbard, what it was describing here, is the tremendous amount of discretion that the prosecution has in deciding what to charge and how many counts to issue. And there being an exclusive control of that evidence other than what the defendant might know him or herself. And by the way, she said she didn't recall any of it. What the defendant has in her possession, the prosecution has all this evidence in his possession and can choose, are we going to go in this direction, are we going to go in that direction, how many counts are we going to issue? And in this instance, the prosecution said, we're charging two major felonies connected with these two injuries here, and if you dare challenge this, I'm going to issue additional charges. You're going to lose a deal, and we're going to see that risk against you go dramatically up, and I'll be less willing to negotiate with you. Okay, we have that's the context. How, under that circumstance, is the defendant supposed to protect the record and go in and say, there's a double jeopardy issue here, and we're going to waive it? The state, if they wanted that to be part of the agreement, had the opportunity to put that on the record. They had it right there in front of them. And they wanted no mention of that in front of the court. And that's why the trial judge could not have known the potential factual problems with the plea. So that's one of the things that reasons why I think Hubbard should be kept. And also, when we take a look at the prosecutorial discretion, we have the potential, and I think it was in this case, where there is dissatisfaction with the amount of exposure to incarceration that can be assessed for a single count, dislike with what the legislature has done for how much time somebody can get. And say, okay, how do we get around that? Well, let's go.
What was the exposure for incarceration on one?
For a single count, it's 15 years imprisonment with maximum 10 years initial incarceration. So,
to affect a legitimate waiver, you would put the burden entirely on the state?
In a plea instance, yes.
Does the defendant ever have a burden?
I think that some of our case law, and arguably I'm somewhat troubled that I didn't spend a lot of time with it, but there's at least one case, was it Kohler, where the assertion was made that if you actually go to trial and you have a full trial on the case, you can't, after the fact, raise a multiplicity argument based upon the facts that argument has to be made before you go to jury trial.
Is that argument that you're making in conflict with the Brochi case?
No, I don't believe so. Let me clarify a little bit, though. And this gets me to the at least three options I see before the court, two of which I don't like. I like Hubbard. I've described that. The other one is the one argued by counsel, which is Brochi, which is if you don't put it on the record, it's gone, you're done. The middle ground is to treat it as in some of the other arguable constitutional violations, failure to make a full and candid disclosure, that subsequent to a challenge being made, if there's a prima facie showing that there was not a record made of a waiver, that you go to an evidentiary hearing and the state has the burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that, in fact, even though there wasn't a common record waiver, that there was still a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of that defense. That's kind of a middle ground, not one that I like because we end up in a circumstance.
Well, here, in this case, there were extensive plea negotiations, as I gather it, from reading the record, particularly when this case went back to Judge Mason, and he and I pointed out to my colleagues, I think that, you know, a 50-page written decision, having been a trial judge, and an issue like this is somewhat unusual, and he seemed to go to great lengths to come to the conclusion that he did. Now, you're saying unless it's on the record, and that's why you don't like Brochi. You don't like Brochi because they didn't put it on the record at the time the plea agreement was made, correct?
There was no explicit waiver on the record in Brochi, that's correct, and there wasn't in this case.
How do you get an express waiver that's going to be any good? So the judge goes through the colloquy and says, I don't rule, and it hasn't been raised here, but there are two counts, and one of them may or may not be in violation of double jeopardy. You know what double jeopardy is, right? And if you went to trial, the state would have to show that there's really only one count, not 35 or whatever it is. And by pleading guilty, you have waived a lot of constitutional objections you might have. You waive your, and one of them is double jeopardy. And the effect would be you'd only be subject to 15 years and 10, not whatever the total is here. So, do you expressly waive your double jeopardy rights? I mean, is that what has to be said?
Under Hubbard, and I wish that Hubbard is followed, it starts with the prosecution standing up and saying, this is a potential double jeopardy issue.
Suppose the prosecution doesn't know that. I mean, in this case, you say they did because it was discussed, if you accept the testimony of the lawyers. But suppose you don't know, it's just that a potential in almost every case, or any case in which there are double counts, and you have this one victim in one time period, right?
Well, and there you have the balance between should the state be required to uphold their responsibility of seeing that they're not falsely or wrongly accusing people of crimes that they didn't commit, uphold that versus in them being in possession of the evidence, or should it be the defendant to try to understand what all the possible ramifications might be.
But is that what you see?
Yeah.
The kind of questioning I just went through, anytime really you have a multiple count?
The question is, who would have a motivation to see that the double jeopardy issue doesn't come back to haunt them, and who's in the best position to be able to identify what that might be? I could see that if the state initiated that discussion and the defense did not say, but we're still reserving this potential over here or that potential over there, that perhaps it would be waived at that point. But I even hesitate at that, because the question comes up is that if, in fact, it's not identified by the state and the defense doesn't supplement or identify additional possible multiplicity, don't we have at least then the prima facie, at least the beginnings that perhaps a ground of double jeopardy and multiplicity that was discovered after the fact was not in fact discussed, was not discovered. In this case, for instance, when I go through what was discussed about multiplicity at the Court of Appeals, trial court level with the testimony, there wasn't a whisper about how the great bodily harm issue poses a second obstacle.
Well, in the colloquy, didn't they say that great bodily harm means, or didn't you go through the elements, defining the elements, they just go through the elements?
I think that there was just the reference to the great bodily harm.
And I think we had a case that said that was good enough.
And the issue is, if you take a look at the definition of great bodily harm, then we come down to, okay, what are we talking about? It may be that with going to that multiplicity hearing, that we find that there's other components of the great bodily harm definition that could be upheld. I don't know that.
Mr. Fairchild, assume for purposes of this question that we agree with your argument, that Robinson, that Hubbard were not followed. All right.
Okay.
I guess my question goes to what we do with the case at that point. If Mena stood for the proposition that there was no basis for the charge, and therefore double jeopardy precluded a conviction on it, and didn't deal with the issue of waiver, do we then send it back for a hearing on whether or not the charge is in fact multiplicitous, and if the court finds that it is not, that's the end of it? The conviction is reinstated? You understand my question?
Yes, I understand the question. In fact, that's been some matter of rather heated discussion at the court below, not in court.
And I guess the reason, yeah, I ask the question is I'm concerned about the ramifications of doing anything else. For example, if we send it back and say, no, the plea is off, you go back to square one, and indeed the charge is not multiplicitous, and the prosecutor increases the charges, isn't your client in a worse position?
Exactly the position argued by the state, and that comes to what I would call kind of the third issue that I hope the court addresses. You haven't even heard of the second issue that I want to be able to mention. I think that that issue, however, has been addressed by the court adequately already, which is essentially that if the defendant is allowed to withdraw their plea, is that then a material and substantial breach of the plea agreement? What remedy is it? And this court has, and I think rightfully, said that the determination what the proper remedy would be is within the discretion of the trial court, taking a look at the totality of the circumstances and the prejudice or impact upon each of the parties and the nature of the breach. And so I think that that's kind of an open question. I think it's been settled. The state has asked in their brief that if you go back, if she's allowed to raise this issue at all. We want, even before the hearing, the plea agreement entirely set aside, that she's close to everything. And she takes her chances of what happens at the hearing on multiplicity. And I think that that's the wrong process, particularly in this case. I think that this matter should be sent back for the hearing on multiplicity, and at that point the court takes a look at, having heard the evidence about the injuries and the issues of the injuries and the arguments of counsels, can make a decision on what's the remedy. Is she allowed to
First, you have to determine, the trial court would have to determine whether it was multiplicitous.
I believe that that's the proper route.
Right. Now, if the trial court determines that it is not multiplicitous, the charge is valid, what does the trial court do?
At that point, I think that the, although there's the issue that I had raised previously about ineffective assistance of counsel that was also found against me at the trial court level, the court at that point presumably reinstates the entire, says that the conviction and the judgment are done and final. We're over.
And if the trial court agrees that the charge is multiplicitous,
then the trial court has to take a look at the totality of the circumstances, the nature of the breach, the impact on both sides, and determine whether, I'm just giving for instances, because there might be additional possibilities at the trial court level, just get rid of, vacate the conviction on the second multiplicitous count, or vacate any final determination on the charges arising out of the injuries to this child, or vacate the entire plea agreement, as argued by the State.
You and the State agree. You agree that should the court hold that there was no waiver, it goes back to the trial court to determine whether the counts are multiplicitous. You both agree. That's what you go back to.
Yes, and I think that the question... Okay.
Right. You both agree at that level. The second level is, if the trial court should find it multiplicitous, what should the trial court do?
I hate to be making arguments for counsel, but I believe that the argument has been that if she gets a hearing at all, even before the hearing, the entire plea agreement is vacated.
Well, as I read page 15 of the State, and maybe I'm reading it wrong, this is the last paragraph. If this court determines that Kelty has not waived her double jeopardy claim by pleading guilty, it should clarify for the trial court that if on remand, the trial court concludes that the two counts were multiplicitous, it, meaning the trial court, should consider an appropriate remedy based on the totality of the circumstances rather than simply vacating one of the counts. Such a remedy could include vacation of the plea agreement and restoration of the parties prior to negotiated plea agreement. So I think you both agree, one, it goes back, if you should prevail here, one, it goes back to the trial court on multiplicitous. Two, if the trial court holds against the State, then the trial court considers totality of the circumstances. That's what you just said. Now, you don't want them to really go back to square one, but that it's possible under considering the totality, right?
And you're correct. Yes.
Well, why shouldn't they go back to square one?
Can.
Well.
Is this not in your client's interests?
Well, yes. You answered his question.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of law that you can't go back to square one, is it?
No.
No. So it's what would be better?
Let me stand correct.
It's a double jeopardy issue if you go back to the higher counts?
Well, when I went looking, albeit not as thoroughly, about what the remedies are, I don't recall coming across a case that talked about vacating the plea in one case that was part of a larger plea agreement where everything was vacated. But I think that that's what is, I think it was Robinson that was talking about that going back to square one is commonly where you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's not a double jeopardy issue if this charge is a higher charge.
Not one that I've seen successfully made.
Right.
So this will be a new requirement, or perhaps old, on the trial court now to in cases of negotiated pleas or a plea agreement to always insert the discussion about double jeopardy.
If there's more than one count.
Well, there often is.
I think the state would have the obligation of alerting the court to that, and perhaps then the court takes it from there.
You know, I have a hesitancy to add to the laundry list of mandatory questions. I don't know if anyone else does, but I do. And it seems to me that, look, you have the premise, arguably, that double jeopardy is an exception to the waiver rule. That the state, if it chooses to, if there's a plea agreement or if there isn't a plea, I guess there, if there is a plea agreement, can have in the agreement an expressed waiver. And if they don't, then in those situations, and I'm not sure there are very many, but in those situations where there's not an expressed waiver, then the defendant on appeal or in the circuit court after the plea is taken can say, hey, look, I want to assert a double jeopardy. And then there is an examination of whether or not, indeed, it's multiplicitous. And then there is, a la Robinson, a consideration of what to do given the totality of the circumstances. I mean, why is there a problem of that kind of flow chart? Now, that doesn't involve the circuit court shall advise. It just says, look, Hubbard's good law, there has to be an express waiver. If I were UDA and this case involved something that was a little questionable that you knew of, I'd make sure I put that on the record, but, you know, sometimes it isn't so obvious, and the DA won't put it on the record. So if there is a double jeopardy violation, and it's raised later, the court determines it. The circuit court has a hearing, decides it, and then comes up with a remedy given the totality of the circumstances. What's wrong with that?
To tell you the truth, I'm not sure I followed all of what you were saying.
No,
but
I'm not going to repeat it. Okay.
I think there are some possibilities. I mean, the current form that's used right now could, in fact, have another checkbox on it.
What's the possibility
there?
Yeah.
What's the possibility without putting another checkbox on the plea questionnaire, without requiring additional, every single time in cases, having a question about double jeopardy and waiver of double jeopardy? I don't want to go there, so what else can you offer?
It would put a burden on the state to be paying attention as they do when they make their initial charging decision and when they enter into a plea agreement as to whether there is a potential for a double jeopardy claim and to raise that attention to the court. The double jeopardy claim, which goes so very fundamentally to the power of the state to bring a prosecution at all, the MENA issue, is as strong and as important, certainly of the right to a jury trial, certainly of the right to counsel, and how we can subordinate it to being kind of the standard of whether the judge has the authority to set the parole date or whether the correct enunciation of an element of a crime was stated, I think really denigrates that protection. We're talking about a mighty power from the state, and the state exercising its discretion. I don't think that it's an impermissible burden to put on them.
Mr. Fairchild, I know your red light is on, but I've got one additional question. As I see the case law, and I could be wrong, and I'll stand corrected if I am, there's no federal requirement under the federal Constitution for an explicit waiver of a double jeopardy claim. There does appear to be a requirement in Wisconsin based on our own cases, both by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. where that requirement has not been followed, all right, and the express waiver is not obtained on the record, are you seeking a remand any time a double jeopardy issue is raised, which would seem to undercut Broci, or are you seeking a remand when there is, in fact, double jeopardy in place? In other words, where you've already established that there's a double jeopardy violation similar to that shown in Mena. Do you understand the question?
I understand the question, and that's the very central question to cases of multiplicity that are based on whether there are separate facts as opposed to separate law in the case. And I think that there would have to be a affidavit, some prima facie showing that there's a potential for multiplicity based on facts made to the court. But if that's made, I think that there needs to be a hearing on it.
See, the concern that I have, and I guess the problem that I have with that, is that when you argue in terms of potential for double jeopardy, Broci specifically went off on the basis of waiver. So if you've waived it, how do you get there absent of showing that you, in fact, have a violation?
Broci is collateral attack. Okay, so that's where it's different. And that's where there's a lower standard. Okay? And the federal courts have not been unanimous in following Broci. In fact, the state's courts haven't either. Wisconsin is not alone in this. Michigan is also.
It's a direct appeal. I assume you follow the federal law, that they do follow the federal law if they apply federal law on collateral stop, collateral remedy. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
If I may, I know my time's up, but if I could just alert the court that the court does send this back to have a hearing on evidence, which I hope it does, could you please address what the standard of proof by the court should be in a multiplicity case where there is a factual dispute?
Standard of proof on whose part? For the state, you want? And what's your proposal?
I think it should be beyond a reasonable doubt, because since this factual issue doesn't go to the jury, there's only one decider of fact, and it goes right to the heart of, are there the facts to support this charge?
They have to find the, you're saying the court has to find the facts beyond a reasonable doubt, but other than that, it's a question of law once the facts are found, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Justice Brasser had a question for you.
If the defendant explicitly waived double jeopardy in a plea, could the defendant still bring a double jeopardy claim under any circumstances?
Indirectly, potentially. I mean, we have the things of still, is there coercion? Was there some false promise? We also have the issue of potentially ineffective assistance of counsel. But then we would be dealing about factual determinations consistent with that set of case law.
Essentially, the argument would be the waiver is no good for a particular defense in the law.
I'm sorry.
There's an express waiver on the record. That was Justice Prosser's question to you. Can you attack the express waiver? That's his question. And your response, as I understood it, is yes, but under the law that deals with validity of waivers.
Correct.
Voluntary coercion, ineffective assistance.
Right.
Not on the double jeopardy issue.
Right. You don't if you don't get to an evidentiary hearing on just the presentation of a prima facie case of non-waiver.
Any other questions? Hearing none, Mr. Wolford, you have several minutes in rebuttal.
Just several things quickly. With regard to Justice Crook's question about whether the court could decide multiplicity on its own, it's true there's never been an evidentiary hearing, and our position is that's because the defendant pled, and they lost their right to an evidentiary hearing. But we, because of waiver, but Obviously, it's going back for an evidentiary hearing, and we...
Did you say obviously?
Well, if the Court of Appeals is affirmed, it's going back. And that's the present status of it. And if that is the case, there was a... I think that would be appropriate that the court could not decide it without the trial court dealing with an evidentiary hearing. And the question was raised about the standard of proof. Our position, Kohler expressly did not decide that issue. Our position is that it would be preponderance of the evidence as it is for waiver of Miranda rights and suppression and some of those issues. And there is case law that supports preponderance of the evidence in other jurisdictions. The defense counsel here talked about how the defendant in this case was only 17 years old and didn't really know what was going on. Should be pointed out at the plea hearing, the defense counsel indicated that she was very bright despite her youth, and the trial court believed the defense counsel's testimony at the post-conviction hearing rather than the defendant's, and found that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel, that she had been provided with plenty of information about double jeopardy.
Mr. Wolford, I understand that opposing counsel has argued that with respect to the state's knowledge of the double jeopardy issue, it was aware of the double jeopardy issue prior to the plea. In view of that knowledge, and in view of at least the requirements of Hubbard and Robinson and Multaylor and some of the other cases, how should we approach this case knowing that the express waiver, which is required by our decisions, might not be required by Boce, but it's required by our decisions, that express waiver was not obtained?
Well, I think that the court should still determine that there's a waiver because those cases, in fact, were not correct. Hubbard was not, in fact, the correct statement of the law. There was a question raised about what the remedy is on remand. It is not our position that before a hearing on multiplicity that the plea agreement should be reopened. It's only if there is found to be multiplicity. And I would draw your attention to State versus Lange, 259 West 2nd, 774, because that case is even more on point than Robinson. It deals with a situation where there were convictions in several different cases, including one that, you know, some that were not before the court on that appeal, that were part of a global plea agreement. And you know, the plea agreement was withdrawn and they started over. And the only other thing I would say about the remedy, in this case, the defendant received the maximum on one charge and 10 years on the second charge. So if the court below would hear this case, you find there's no waiver and it goes back and they find it's multiplicitous and they knock out that second count, there's no way to change the sentence on the first count to try to achieve the same dispositional scheme as was originally contemplated. So I think that supports putting parties back where they began.
Thank you, Attorney Wolford. Thank you, Attorney Fairchild, for your arguments today on yet another double jeopardy and waiver case. And that concludes our hearing in 03AP3055 CR State versus Kelty. The court is in recess, and I will be discussing the issue of what we do with our last case with Assistant Attorney General Greg. Okay, we're in recess. Go to lunch.